One quick message before I start the show. You can find all the links and resources for this episode by visiting the show notes on rickyrichards.com. If you enjoy this episode, do consider subscribing on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you're feeling particularly generous, you can help me to grow the show by leaving a review on iTunes. For anyone who does subscribe, review or share, thank you. I appreciate it. Now let's get into the show. Welcome to Ricky Richards Represents, the show where I talk tips for success with leading figures of creativity and innovation. Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the show. My guest today is Dave Bonaguidi. Dave has worked in the advertising industry for over 30 years, in which time he's co-founded three agencies, St. Luke's, Karmarama, and most recently his new venture, Unlimited Inc. He's also worked at several great agencies, being a creative director at Channel 4, is that correct?
Yeah, I was creative director at Channel 4, but within that we set up 4 Creative, so it was a...
There we go. And continues to this day to be an artist. Mm. On top of this, Dave's also been a powerful voice and has spoken openly about all aspects of the industry, from creative excellence, diversity, education, and most recently, copyright and originality. I've been looking forward to this conversation for many weeks. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I thought we could start off. You left CP&B.
Yeah.
What's the story there? And also let us know about your new place.
Yeah, I mean, I'd only worked at CPB for a couple of years, actually. Started in, it would have been July 15, following a kind of year of gardening leave that I had when I left Karmarama. And to be honest, I was actually thinking of setting up another business at the time, and had had a conversation with Chuck Porter and the team that were running the London office. Chuck Porter is the P out of CPB, and I kind of knew him a little bit. He tried to buy Karmarama when it was quite small, when we were about 5 years old, and I'd always sort of stayed in contact with him and I have a huge amount of respect for him. And we had a kind of conversation and he said, what are the kind of things that you really want to do? And to be honest, I was at the stage where, you know, when you constantly set up agencies and then leave them, there's an issue, which is, for me, it was always that once an agency that I'd set up had become established or had become an agency, it kind of... They sort of ceased to function in the way that I'd like them to, which is to constantly challenge and develop into something constantly being interesting. And I think CPB was certainly one of those agencies that has always been at the kind of forefront of anything interesting in marketing. You know, they had a healthy disrespect for traditional advertising. They were very involved in their kind of heyday in that kind of 90s, early noughties period where they were kind of doing lots of stuff that was... getting into the social field and experiential.
Paddy Power, they did a lot of good stuff.
Paddy Power was fantastic. I mean, I absolutely love that work from the London office, but the American offices were always very good at kind of, I don't know, they just kind of had a real swagger and confidence about them, and they were kind of, you know, a great agency. And so the chance to work for them was something that I couldn't really refuse, and especially when they turned around and said, you can pretty much do all the things that you really want to do here. And within, you know, a month of going there, I actually had more freedom working for some there than I had in my own agency. I remember some of the things, we were just like, why don't we just try and do this? They were like, just do it. Just do it. And if it doesn't work, stop doing it and do something else. And if it does work, well, stop doing it and do something else. So it was a kind of, there was a big reinvention thing that I loved. The team were really good. I think after about 18 months, I think I'm just one of those people that just got to work for myself. And I love working for them, and I love working with them. And like I said, I think the world of Chuck and all the American guys and some really, really talented blokes out there, and girls, obviously. But it was just one of those things where I just thought perhaps I'd copped out when I left Karma and had that year, that I really should have gone for something and tried to do something different. And in a way, I kind of... It's like that bit in... In Carlito's way, you know, when I thought I was getting back out, they dragged me back in. And so I just kind of thought I was just doing the same thing that I'd done for a long time. And
so did you go out in a ball of fire?
No. Hold on, I'm choking. I'm choking on one of those Lindt chocolate balls. It was one of those things. Unfortunately, I'm a once I get it in my head, that's it.
Well, I wanted to, because it seems like it's been a similar trajectory to myself in that I've hopped around from agency to agency and I get really bored really quickly and I'm just super discontent and I've got 100 side projects on the go at any one time.
Well, to be honest, and I think that's something you should be really proud of and that's something you should absolutely nurture. I think one of the issues that I've got with the industry is it's really vanilla. We have become a factory of beige and we're quite happy to make beige and muzak and everything that is banal and boring. And very few places sort of go, fuck it, let's try and challenge that and make it better. And I don't know whether I'm just an old punk at heart or... But I like people who kind of go, yeah, all right, everybody else is doing that. Why don't we try and do something different? And I think it creates a much more interesting universe for staff and for clients because I think both of those groups of people need diverse offers, you know. All creatives don't want to work in the same sort of place. Everybody has a different vibe. And all clients deserve different types of, you know, bespoke businesses that will treat them in the way that they deserve to be treated. And in a way, that was the thing that frustrated me a little bit about CPB was it's a great ad agency. And what I was doing, we had a job to do there, which was to sort out some of the issues of the London office. And we sorted those out a little bit too quickly, actually. I thought it was going to be a little bit more of a project, like 3 or 4 years, but we sort of did it in about 18 months and we're kind of making money again and trying to build the culture a little bit more and, you know, attract people and grow. And then I just thought I'm going to end up repeating what I've done for a long time. So we just jumped out of a... The analogy we use is we jumped out of a perfectly good aeroplane that was going to quite an interesting place.
Right.
Which seems suicidal, but for me it was like, you know, if you're anything to go by, you know, I get bored very, very easily. If I feel like I'm doing a stick and repeat, I'll go.
Yeah.
And I sort of need a little bit of fear and something or energy or something in my life to make me feel...
You've been a huge advocate of that as well, haven't you? The idea of if you're not satisfied, just jump ship. I mean, a lot of agencies kind of want you to be there for at least 3-4 years and to tick the boxes. And people kind of do that under the assumption that if they don't do that, that it's going to look bad on their career history. Yeah. It's not really been the case for myself. It's like you take from those experiences and you roll it onto your next.
Well, I think that's a really refreshing attitude, that, because oddly enough, I don't know, where did you go to college?
So I studied in Worcester, which was at the bottom of the Good Uni Guide.
Okay.
And for graphic design. And yeah. So it kind of gave me this right from the off. I was like, right, I'm going to have to hustle.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's kind of barrel rolled all the way through.
Well, I think, you know, the fact, I mean, similar to me, I did graphics at college. You know, they didn't have advertising courses back in, you know, 1902. But it was, a lot of it is just like, I want to try it. And if I enjoy it, I'll carry on doing it. And the minute I don't enjoy it, I'll leave. And so, you know, I did that when I set up an agency called St. Luke's back in the day and did that for a few years and then kind of got bored with that and then went, right, I've got a chance to go and work as a client at Channel 4. And then when I left Channel 4, it's to set up another business. And it's always like trying to, you know, I just want to basically fill my life with as many interesting things as possible. And I think with me, there was a big turning point when I left Karma. Obviously, leaving your own business can be... quite a thing to get your head round, because, you know, most people in advertising, you think, you set up my business and I work there for a while, sell it to Martin Sorrell, make some money, go and live in Norfolk or Lanzarote, depending on how good the deal is, and then you kind of, you know, and then you sort of go, right, that's my life done, and now I can just get fat and die,
or have the Chinese hookers or whatever,
or Chinese hookers or whatever it is you like.
Yeah.
But for me, it was just like I sort of sat there and thought, God, you know, I was 50 when I left Karl Rahm. I thought, blimey, I've got fewer years ahead of me than I've got in front of me. And do I want to carry on working there? And I just thought, no. And then it became a really, really simple decision just to go, well, go and do something else. And it doesn't matter how much money you don't get or what. It doesn't matter, because it's the most important thing is you've got your sanity.
On top of your sanity, you talk quite a lot about the work being vanilla.
Mm.
And I've been trying to formulate what my philosophy is on what constitutes good work recently. And to some degree, I've come up with this idea that we should stop trying to create stuff which is almost like someone interrupting in a conversation, and actually be creating the stuff that people are actively going towards. So instead of doing the YouTube pre-roll, let's create the video that people are going to watch.
Exactly.
Or you gave a lovely example of Top Gun being a feasible recruitment thing, and I love the idea that, you know, something as compelling and as loved as a film could be subtly a campaign if done correctly. What's your philosophy?
Exactly that. I mean, it's. I've just got to say, I just find the whole concept of marketing so sort of second division. It just sort of feels like it's necessity, and it's kind of, you know, it's very important. But I don't think it's the cutting edge of smart-minded, creative problem solvers working with business. It is now. It's just become an absolutely colouring in by numbers exercise. You're told what to say. You're told where it's going to go. You know how long it's going to be. You know how much money you haven't got to spend on it. And so you just end up packaged. Everything looks the fucking same. You know, everything looks the same. We've now also, even worse, we've slipped into an era where if somebody's done it before, that's good. Whereas I remember working for Steve Henry at Hal Henry. And you'd have to show him 10 bits of work for everything. 10 campaigns, all properly thought through. And they all had to be original. And he would show you'd show him the first one, and he'd go, no, boys, halfway through it, you'd be reading it, and he'd go, no, stop. They did that in Japan in 1948. And he'd go, but Steve, you know, I was born in 64, how would I know that? He goes, doesn't matter, you should know that. And there was a level of, I don't know whether it's pride or kind of self something, that you would just, you know, you sort of go, no, everything we do has to be original. Now, Hal Henry at the time, you know, had a lot of pride in the fact that it did do that. You know, it was constantly reinventing the wheel and trying new stuff. And to be honest, you know, they probably missed 5 times out of 10, but when they hit, it was amazing. And they did some sensational work, but it's that kind of thing of every opportunity. Steve used to do this thing where he'd turn around and he'd be doing a beer mat. We did a beer mat once for Molson. Client comes in and goes, yeah, I want to do print ads and all that posters stuff, but we want to do some beer mats. And I remember at the time, me and my partner went, fucking really? What, beer mats? And Steve went, no. Let's do the most talked about beer mat out there. And when you think about it like that, if you can do a beer mat that gets people talking, what a brilliant ambition to go out there with, rather than just, well, let's just put a logo on it with the end line on the other side and that'll do. Because it will do. That'll work. That's what everybody else does. But Steve always had this sort of thing of, no, keep going. And I think that's the thing that's constantly driven me. Even though I don't work for Steve anymore, I still feel like I've got him in my fucking head going, but Dave, it could be this, it could be that. You could be, you know, and so I think that's, I suppose it's just like when you've been in the army for a long time, you come out and you stand up straight and you do your bed in the morning and you polish your shoes. It's just the way you've been groomed.
So Steve's there in the back of your head in your subconscious.
Yeah, and always.
You've got a new company now, but you've successfully built 2 agencies before.
Mm. I don't know, successfully. I mean, built them. I mean, they're still around,
which is
places I'd want to work.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. But what I was curious to know is, just from an entrepreneurial perspective, so you've been very open about the fact that you stole a bunch of clients from one place to start up. Was that St. Luke's or Kalmarama?
Which one are you talking about? Because there was certainly when we did St. Luke's.
Yeah.
It was, we were kind of, we were another agency. We were Chiat Day. And we got sold overnight. So we got a phone call on a Sunday evening saying, you've got to go into a hotel in Russell Square and you've got to listen to this. They're going to do a video link where they kind of had the agency over in New York and LA sort of saying, we've got wonderful news. We've done a deal with TBWA. And everyone was like, wow, that's quite cool. But we'd already been pre-warned by the management team, the rest of the management team in London going, it's bad, because obviously TBWA were non-existent in the States at the time. They were very, very good in London at the time. They had Trevor Beattie and it was a fucking rocking agency. And so, you know, we were like 30 people, very small. And so we were going to be like, oh, okay, I know what's going to happen to us. We're all just going to get assimilated, spat out the other end. They'll take all the clients and they'll just crack on. And right at the end of this kind of video link, somebody was like, and this is what it means in LA, this is what it means in New York, and then we heard this funny voice go, hey, and what does it mean for the guys in London? And then it just went, and the video link died, and we all went, oh, shit. And it was exactly that. We were all going to go. So we just did a deal where we just said, well, look, if we don't want to be part of this deal. David Abraham, who's now the chief exec at Channel 4, was part of the team, so there were 6 of us who were running at the time. I was one of them. And we just said, well, we don't want to be part of this deal. And if we can take all of our clients and all of our people, spoke to the clients, and they said, well, if you can guarantee all the people working on my business on Friday night are there on Monday morning, we'll go with you. And literally, we just took it, and it was like just moving house. We just found cheaper rent, well, rent-free accommodation, and we took all the clients.
So in that circumstance, it's easy to see how you built that. With Karmarama, I'd love to go through the process of how you go from deciding you're going to start a company and then turning it into, because Karmarama is a very well-established agency now. When you're a small team, I can imagine you getting your hands on a few 20 to 50K jobs, but that is...
Not even that. I mean, when we started Karmarama, I was working at Channel 4. The bloke I was working, I did it with, Naresh, was... He'd left St. Luke's. So we did St. Luke's together. We'd worked at Hal Henry together, so we had history. He came in to one day at Channel 4 and said, why don't we do our own thing? And I was like, okay, I'm a sucker for a fucking startup. So I just went, yeah, okay, what do we do? And so I started designing letterheads and all the stuff that you do. And we worked out in my kitchen when I lived in Spitalfields, and we were in my kitchen for about 2 months and just got some computers and just started doing it. I'll tell you the thing that kind of helped us massively was Channel 4 were very, very supportive and said, if you're going to go off and set up your own thing, we'll become your founding client. So that was like lovely.
Channel 4 in your kitchen.
Yeah, very useful. And then Mother, Naresh had worked at Mother for about 6 to 8 months and been helping them out. And so Robert Savile and the rest of the guys up there were very, very generous towards us. And I think they were just very kind. And, there were lots of situations where they would have clients just walking in off the street going, can you do work for us? And then they would go, well, we need more money from you and you haven't got it. So why don't you try these guys? They're kind of preferred partners. And so, we got gifted lots and lots of interesting little bits of business, things like Selfridges and we did some good projects for them. I think the thing that always drives you, I mean, yeah, I'm a dirty immigrant spawn. And so you always have that thing of, save money, put money aside. So when we set up the business, we set it up with, I don't know, like $4,000 each. We had no rent because it was in my kitchen. We just got a computer each and a printer, and that was it.
So who's your first hire? In fact, could you take us through, I don't know, how do you go from two people in a kitchen to a team of 10?
Yeah, well, we had at Karmarama, there were a young team called Dan and John, who had worked at Hal Henry. They'd also been, I think for some time, they'd been at St. Luke's for a little bit. So we kind of knew of them, and they came in and they were like, they were on about $10,000 a year. So exactly the same way that when Hal Henry started, there were five partners. They had a PA and a receptionist who happened to be the same person. And we were higher number two and three because we were the cheapest people they knew. I mean, I was earning $10,000 a year at WCRS, got fired. And then we went to Hal Henry.
Did you get equity stake?
No, God, no. No, we took a pay cut.
Right.
They said that you have to come in on $8,000. And we were like, yeah, whatever. We're unemployed. In those days, there was never any mention of equity. It was not, the guys at Hal Henry never set up that business to sell it. It happened. But they certainly never set it up.
But I think that's almost why there's I feel like there's a bit of a creative drain because the tech industry offers that and it has some such upsides that for a lot of people it doesn't seem sensible.
Well,
it
does have upsides, but it doesn't have upsides if you're trying to build up an agency and an ad agency and sell it. I mean, there's no margin anymore.
I don't mean that. I know that we've been saying for a long time now that the creative isn't good enough in our industry, and I wonder where that talent's going.
You're right, and that's a good question. It's not going into advertising, because I think if you've got a laptop now and an idea, why the fuck would you want to go into a business like advertising? I mean, it's like prehistoric compared to any other business. As an example, we're Unlimited. We're kind of working with a online bank, a mobile bank. Pretty modern, the guy who founded it is Estonian. Estonia, if you know anything about them, I mean, it's like, they gained independence from Russia in 96, 98, whatever it was. They've been born into a modern era. They are just digitized as a nation. And they're the people who gave us, Skype, all of these fucking really, really cool brands that are changing the world. The last conversation I had in an ad agency, we spent well, I wasn't in the meeting, thank God, but they spent probably about an hour discussing the makeup of the people in the room. So we need a woman. We need a black guy or a brown guy. Are there any gay people that we can put in the meeting room so that we look really diverse? Because advertising, let's face it, is still predominantly white male, middle class, heterosexual. And even the women, I'd say this is going to kill me, but one of the issues I also found was that a lot of the women in the business are as bad as some of the men. And so you create this thing that's just like...
They still
celebrate the things that all that mercenary side of the business is very good at celebrating, which is power, control. You know, an individual who owns a group of a large advertising group can give himself a £50 million summer bonus. I think it's just despicable. Call me old-fashioned. I think it is. A lot of people still aspire to think that that's something to aspire to. I find it really, really complicated and confusing. Maybe I'm my politics are probably Buddhist communist with maybe a little bit of fascism thrown in because of the Italian side.
That's a new religion you're forming.
But, yeah,
there.
all the sort of places that I've really enjoyed working in have had really strong, we look after ourselves culture. We don't do it. I mean, that's why St. Luke's was named St. Luke's, because not after the six people who were the managing partners, but it was also to avoid one or two people being seduced by the concept of a sale. So by making it equal ownership for everybody, and we had, Rose the cleaner, she had an equal share. And it was reissued every year. I don't know. Certainly
going
not something they do
pentagram
anything
pentagram model.
But it was a very, very, the design companies can do it.
Yeah.
But why ad agencies were still named after the four men that set them up, and it was just different.
This is, and I can see that money, you've said in the past, don't be afraid of making money. But
yeah.
So obviously Karmarama sold a couple years ago, I believe, for an estimated 50 million. I'm sure you know the actual figure.
Yeah, I don't think it was 50 million.
As a co-founder, I wondered if you became a millionaire off of the back of this, just out of interest, because you don't seem to have changed your ways particularly, if you have. And then also, I just
do a lot more cocaine.
Yeah,
but, hey.
I've got questions about this.
but
there's another thing that I read online, and I didn't really understand it, and I thought maybe you could explain it to me, which was Karmarama had a debt-funded private equity structure that meant it paid interest to its owners and made a pre-tax loss of 5.7 million.
Hmm.
And I just don't understand what that means at all.
Yeah, I don't really understand that. I mean, what happened was in 2011...
Yeah.
Karmarama was all self-funded when we started it. Like I said, it was me and one other bloke put $4,000 into it. We built it up to about 85 people. Then we had lots of people sniffing around us because there was a sort of period from about 2008 to about 2012 where we were kind of... I think somebody best described it as you're sitting at a table you have no right to be sitting at. And it was purely because of the culture that we had there, which was we just had a fucking laugh. We just had a laugh doing stuff. We tried stuff. We didn't have any fear about failing. We were just cocky, confident, and stupid, which is a beautiful combination. no ad group would ever touch us because, what they want, the ad people, Sorrel to buy you, they want to see big, big numbers on, profits and all that kind of stuff. I mean,
They want a machine that's
very easy to order.
Yeah.
And we were wild, it was like... It was like a frat house more often, but it was a lovely place to work. Venture capital came and got involved. Some the private equity people came in and went, "We'd like to build a group around you." And we're like, "Okay, well that sounds good." And I was a little bit like, "Well, it's not selling, which is nothing I ever wanted to do." I mean, if they can put some money into us and then help us, we were really dirty immigrant in the way that we grew, which was, we'd had. The same thing that every small business, any business under 10 years would have experienced extraordinary highs and unbelievable lows. And as a result of those lows, what you do is you become very, very cautious. So you sort of go, right, well, we're not going to spend any money until we've had it in the bank for a year. And then when we find that right person, we'll get them and we won't just play. When these private equity guys came involved, they gave us... I suppose, a little bit of confidence, which was they backed us with some money. They said, right, we'll help you. If you want to invest in tech, if you want to invest in programmatic, whatever you want to invest in, we'll help you because we'll help you grow. But obviously, with private equity, their ambition is, yeah, we're going to put some money in.
You're having to deliver
baby in 3 years' time. 3 years' time, we want to flop it and we want to make quite a lot more out of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I, to be honest, I'd never even thought about selling.
Yeah.
When they came along and said that, you can't, I suppose you not fall for it. They were really nice people. They seemed very civilised. They had kind of ambition. They seemed to see something in us, which was, I suppose, quite nice. And they paid us some money up front and then said, right, in 4 years' time, we'll sell it and then you'll make some more money.
It's quite interesting because it doesn't strike me as a particularly good proposition for a venture capitalist because agencies tend to be so, what's the word? Basically, they can go up and down, can't they? You lose a big client.
Yeah, I mean, there's that wonderful quote, but I think it was Bogle said, you know, you're only ever, everyone is three phone calls away from annihilation. And, you know, in the early days of Karmarama, I'd had those three phone calls three or four times. You know, there were moments when it was like, man, it's over. And then suddenly something would happen and you'd find a £50 note on the floor and it'd be like, shit.
Turning okay, around to back your frat house, like, how am I going to pay
game.
These people?
Yeah, and it was, but it was like that. You know, anybody who's done a business will know that it's like that. When they came along, it was, I suppose it was quite flattering as well. And the idea of being able to play on a slightly bigger playing field and be invited to a party that we really weren't invited to, especially with the attitude that we had and the kind of personality that we had, because we were completely different to anybody else out there. But I think it became very, very corporate. We suddenly found ourselves acquiring a much bigger company than ours. And, you know, we were the holders of all the culture. And these guys came in and they weren't really the same sort of thing. And
when you say you acquire another company as the co-founder, don't you have a decision in that?
Well, yeah, but even though I was a co-founder, I wasn't a major shareholder. One of the biggest mistakes I ever made, gave away all the equity. So, you know, there was a stage when Naresh left in 2005 and I suddenly had, you know, 90% of a company that was worth nothing. And there was one other guy. So I just said, well, look, let's start it again. We'll go 50-50. That was a big mistake. I should never have done that. And then when somebody else came in quite senior, we went, right, let's go 33s. And then somebody else came in and we went 25. So I just diluted all of the equity that I had. But I had equity, I had a lot of equity of a company that was worth shit all. So yeah. It kind of made sense at the time. Looking back on it, what it did was it put me in a weaker position because my ambition was never to sell. Whereas the other three, their ambition might have been to sell. Right. So it was like you're always going to get outvoted.
And I suppose that's why you're not worried about the equity split at that moment in time if you don't intend on selling.
Yeah, because equity doesn't mean anything. I mean, it's like until you have a moment, and the ambition was never to have a moment. I always just thought we can just keep growing this thing and make it more fun, and if they set up an office, they want to do an office in Australia or the States or China, great. And you know, at some stage I'll be too old and they'll tell me to piss off and then we'll, you know, I'll be all right. But it was, there's a certain attitude shift that happens when, when you start taking yourself a bit too seriously, something dreadful happens. The Japanese call it victory disease. And apparently there was a story that when Pearl Harbor happened, all the Japanese were on the aircraft carriers kind of cheering and laughing and drinking champagne or sake. And the emperor went, fuck, we've got victory disease, which basically is just, it's a beautiful, beautiful comment to sort of say in your moment of greatest victory, you're fucked because attitudinally you think you've achieved everything. And I think we just, I don't know, for me, it just became a bit too corporate and I'm just not corporate.
You got victory disease.
Well, you know what? I don't think I ever did. I mean, I just suddenly looked about and I saw lots of people kind of who were there for a reason rather than just because they wanted to be there. There was a specific reason they wanted to be there, which was it would look good on the LinkedIn profile. They could make some money at the end of it. Well, you know, I've got no worry about that. I mean, people are people. You know, everyone's got a different agenda. But it's like it's when your agenda kind of starts to distort the vision of the brand, which is should be all more, you know, no one is as big as the club. And there was just a bit of that going on.
In the second section of the interview, I wanted to talk to Dave about his outlook on a number of topics. Dave has been very open about his views,
and I wanted to discuss his belief on how we may rectify a number of these issues he talks about.
You touched on briefly there about the people and the fact that they were looking to leverage you at the time. And I know that you've spoken numerous times about diversity in the workforce, and you've been known to have policies where you don't hire people like me, basically white British chaps who...
We do.
Yeah.
As long as you're not a wanker. Karmarama, one of the things... I remember talking to Jay Chai years ago, and he would always say, how big do you get before you get bad?
Yeah.
And his theory was it was about 70 people. And he said, it's a bit like if you get into the lift in the New York offices at Chart Day and you don't know the person you're standing opposite, you don't know their relationship issue, what they're working on, where they live and what they drive, then there's something's gone. Now, you have that when there's 30 of you and you're all sleeping in the same bed and you're all working late and, you know. Now, of course, that happens. But I think one of the things that always fascinated me was I would love to be, you know, the French have got a French culture that they can have 56 million people and they're French. And the Italians can have a culture. Why can't a business get over 75 people without it all collapsing? Well, it's because there are too many agendas going on. The people who are running it are there for the money. The people who are there working are there to work to make money for the people upstairs, which is a corrupt agenda. So we had a very simple formula, which was, Karmarama, the whole concept of the agency was it was based on karma, which is absolutely ridiculous. You know, we do the right thing. This is how naive and idealistic me and Naresh were when we set it up. And it was, you know, out of the back of St. Luke's, which was cooperative. So we're, you know, real commies at heart. But it was, you know, if we do the good thing over there, then it'll somehow come back to us, which is a beautiful idealistic vision of the world. But it doesn't really have much of a place in a kind of very capitalist business like advertising. But it kind of works, and it still does. I think they still live off that. But the thing that kind of that I think held us together was the fact that we didn't enter creative awards, because I think for me that creative awards are the biggest cancer in the business. Well, one of them. There are two, which is, you know, the kind of the big groups. But then the creative awards and the obsession with those is just awful. And I think that they have held the business back generations. I think they have corrupted what we do, and they have belittled what we do. And I think it's also created a whole generation of people who work in the business who haven't got a fucking clue what they're supposed to be doing anymore, which is awful. And it's like trying to pull out of that nosedive is going to take a lot of effort. And I don't know if anybody's actually interested. So we said no creative awards right off the bat. But that's something I've done before. We, you know, Naresh and I did it at Chart Day. We did it at St. Luke's. I'm not interested in what other people think of the work that we produce at the agency. All I care about is the people who do it and the people who pay for it. And then the consumer that we're talking to.
Yeah, you've said numerous times that, and I'm 100% behind you on this philosophy, that really we should be delivering results to our clients more so than getting awards on our whatever.
Yeah.
Which is where you talked earlier about marketing, and I'm quite interested in marketing because they measure things. But then also I'm from a creative background and I appreciate ideas, and I feel like there's two worlds there, one of them which is very metric driven and the other one which is just all about creativity but oftentimes not very effective. And the harmony of the two is like the
that's beautiful. That's the moment. That's kind of the kind of the overlap that you want, because it's like as a creative person, you're looking to solve problems, fix things, make things work. And then when you're given issues, a problem, and here's some data that either backs up that problem or shows you the way out. I mean, data is just a science. All we are is scientists trying to find a cure for cancer. And you're using all of that information. But advertising is like scientists trying to cure cancer, but they don't want to look at the information because they're scared of it. Whereas you'd think if you're going to try and do something that powerful and that worthwhile for those people, for that kind of money and that time that you spend doing it, that using all of that information would be the most valuable thing that you have.
Well, we've got an absolute bucket full of information.
Yeah. Right?
Like it used to be, and I've ranted about this before, but, five people in a room, what do you think of this ad? And, you know, there's one person who's particularly opinionated that sways everyone else. But now we've got hundreds of thousands of search results from this global search engine. And where are people spending their time? We've got cookies on every website and mobile data and GPS data, and we know everything about people.
And let's also not forget that the people who are giving us that information are also big bullshitters. So Facebook, they all get pulled up for all of that money that they've been making out of the media companies and out of brands, and it's all bogus. It's all fucking fake. You know, all the numbers don't add up. You know, you've got stuff where, who's it? Is it P&G just pulled 100 million of their budgets out of digital and it had absolutely no effect whatsoever on sales? Now, I kind of go, wow, somebody has been ripping you off somewhere quite substantially over the last 5 to 10 years. 100 million and it had no effect at all. Now, that, I think, kind of summarises one of the issues in advertising, which is just there's so much of it.
How do they know that?
Well, I think they've just stopped paying.
But what I mean is if they haven't pumped it in, they don't know what their sales could have been.
Yeah, I suppose so. Well, I suppose they're just comparing it to previous years.
Yeah.
They've just gone, wow, it had no effect at all. I mean, it's like, you know, I love this sort of beta landscape that we're in, which is just, let's just try that. If it doesn't work, turn it up. There was a lovely thing that I used to get told at Channel 4, which was, if it doesn't work, change it as quickly as possible. And they would do that. You know, I remember doing a job once, got a phone call at 2 a.m. from somebody saying, we need your permission to take it off air. And I was asleep and I just went, yeah, whatever, do it. And then in the morning, I went down, spoke to a guy called Steve, who was a director, who directed the piece that was going on air that he had to take off. And he said, I said, did you get a phone call really early in the morning? He says, yeah, about 2:30. He says, all right, I've shot something this morning down at the multi-story car park. It's rendering now. It'll be on air in an hour. And I just went, great, I'm in safe hands. They're all responsible adults who can sit there and go, if it's wrong, change it as quickly as possible. And that would never have happened in an ad agency. It would have taken 3 weeks just to get the 5 people in the room to work out what the brief is now going to be, you know, which is just pointless. But the thing at 4 was they also had this theory that if you do something really good, then change it just as quick, because don't sit back, which is another thing that we're very guilty of in advertising, which is we go, hey, let's take the rest of the year off. We've just done an ad. Let's relax. It was good as well. Let's relax even longer. Drink some champagne. And they're there. It's just like, if you're creating culture through your programming and your brand vibe, then everything that you do has to have that same mentality, which is just reinvent, reinvent, reinvent. And it's a very challenging tool. But if you once you get used to it, it is like being in the army. Once you get that into you, drilled into you, you just do it naturally. But we have no incentive to do that in advertising.
Going on a slight tangent, I'm keen for young people to kind of extract some wisdom from you. So,
oh God,
there's a lot of people that struggle to get into the industry.
Yeah, don't bother.
Yeah, well, that's one thing, right?
Could you pass me that water?
Of course, yeah. What do you think young creatives do wrong?
Well, the first thing they do is they go to colleges where they get taught how to do advertising by people who don't work in the business anymore for a huge amount of money. I mean, college, too expensive. For a one-year course, it costs you about, what, 10 grand? Now, I don't know anybody that can afford to pay 10 grand for a course and then try and live down here. So that's going to add another 10, 15 grand on it. The only people who can afford to do that are people whose mum and dad work in advertising. We don't need any more of them. They're the ones who fucked it up in the first place. You don't need their kids in here doing it again, trying to enjoy the fun that their mum and dad had. I think, you know, that's a big, big problem. Education is too restrictive, too expensive, and doesn't reflect society in any way at all.
Didn't you try and establish your own thing?
Yeah, failed miserably. It was to try and set up a sort of free creative school. I didn't want it to be an ad school. It was to be a free creative school so that if the next, you know, Johnny Ive or the next Dave Trott is on the Isle of Skye and it's a woman... At the moment, we just carry on holding our breath. It's never going to happen. But I just really wanted to try and do something that was government-funded, industry-funded, that would enable us to find new talent that was probably not even thinking about getting into the industry. Because my issue has always been that the people who want to get into the industry are the wrong people. If they want to get into advertising, you don't need any people like that. You want people who... want to challenge it. I suppose it's that thing of now that advertising has become recognised as a business where you can get paid quite a lot of money to be creative, on paper it looks brilliant. But it's a little bit like the analogy we used earlier, which was once you've built up a business that is recognised and everyone goes, oh, yeah, I really want to work there because it's really cool. They would never go there when it was set up, when it was starting up, because they'd be like, oh, that's too risky. But I'll go there now that it's established and it's got, you know, it's got momentum. I think that's what the business has become. It's just become a bit, you know, everyone knows what it is. They look at the ads. No one sits there and goes, they're shit. Everyone just sort of goes, yeah, they're all right, aren't they? Look, you get to eat sushi a lot and you get to go on shoots and it's all great fun. But nobody challenges it. And I think we need more people that might you know, what the people that you mentioned earlier that aren't going into advertising, that are going off to set up their own businesses in whatever field, we need some of that entrepreneurial spunk to 100%. Come in. And
I mean, we were talking about Melanie Mercer earlier, yeah. who we've actually done a podcast with her, and she's hardcore, man. Mm. Like, if she was in any ad agency, they'd
shit themselves.
Yeah,
yeah,
they really would, because it's entrepreneurs versus creatives are just different beasts, in my opinion.
But what's interesting about her is she's still a woman.
Yeah,
she's not a geezer bird. Yeah. Now, that's a really unpleasant term, but there are lots of women in the ad business that are, like I said earlier, are kind of just as bad as the men. They love all the big cars. They love all the carpet in the car, first class travel. They like all of that kind of stuff. And I think what this business needs is a load of shit kickers who are kind of getting roll their sleeves up and start messing around with stuff and challenging and going, why are we still doing it like that when we should be doing it like this? And why are we still employing people like that when we should be finding people like this? And why are we even fucking thinking about doing the same things that we were doing 40 years ago? Because that's effectively what we're still doing. We should be thinking, we should be modernising the business.
Yeah, I often talk about, I try and explain to the people in the business, about these emerging things which are happening. What can we do with this? Where, okay, it may not be massively mainstream right now, but we should be thinking and trying to push and do different stuff.
Well, as creative problem solvers and entrepreneurs, I think you mentioned it at the beginning, which is instead of sitting there trying to do the interesting bit of pre-roll, we should be doing the content that the pre-roll sits behind or sits in front of. But we don't see it like that. We still think that all the joy is in the pre-roll. And then how do you get people to get past 3 seconds?
Yeah.
Why? Why? Yeah. We should be doing, we thieve stuff constantly. We sit there and the first point of creativity is let's look what somebody else has done and then nick it. Well, which is like, fuck, as creative people, shouldn't we be sitting there going, even if you found other things that you could do, like be a photographer, be an artist, be a director on the side, learn things that you can then apply to your job so that when somebody goes, oh, we've got this interesting brief, and then you can go, yeah, why don't we do it like this because I've worked out how to do it. Instead of, I've been watching YouTube and I found some bloke in Norway who makes these little videos in his kitchen and we'll just rip that off. Just lazy.
Talking about ripping off, this transitions lovely into the ongoing feud you've been having recently with Savills, is that correct?
Savills and Isabel. Yeah.
Which you felt was kind of clear plagiarism of your work.
Well, I've got to say, it was always very, very tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah.
My Instagram feed is just a joke.
Yeah.
There's no seriousness in there whatsoever.
Did you? I quite liked their reply. I thought it was quite funny.
Yeah.
What did you think?
Well, it was entirely predictable.
Yeah.
I mean, it was funny because I just got sent it by somebody who said, oh, look, did you do this? And I was like, no, I didn't. And then I just played a game with it. I just said, oh, look, printed a picture of it and just published a picture of it and just said, the chairman has, they did take it, but they've paid me and the chairman's going to let me have his house in Lanzarote for 2 weeks. and then somebody got in contact and said, blimey, that's amazing. How did you get the chairman from Savills to... I said it was a fucking joke. And then I did another one saying he's not only apologised, and we bought tickets for Chelsea Arsenal, but he's also given me some of his favourite jazz mags. And people were still going, how'd you do that? How'd you get his jazz mags? I was like, it's a joke. And then they then contacted me and said, oh, we'll... Because I said to him, oh, what's this all about? Can you explain this? Tongue in cheek. And then they said, oh, we'll check with our agency. And I went, oh, I didn't really... I thought it was just something they'd done in-house. So I then contacted Isabel. And then I just thought, right, now let's have a bit of fun. And said, right, well, if you're going to use stuff that is very, very similar to mine, I'm just going to use Savills with a Z, and I'll do some ads saying we sell houses and flats with a Z, and do it as a screen print, which I did. And then it just escalated from there, because the more they ignored me, the more I just thought, well, fuck, if you're going to ignore me, I'm just going to keep going.
You caused a nice little shitstorm on the internet for the creative industry for a little while.
Well, it was quite fun, wasn't it? But
it was
funny because, obviously, I sit in both camps. I work in advertising and I know this shit happens all the time and I'm guilty of it as well, guaranteed.
Well, this is, like, even, the best examples I've found to date are the Sony bouncy balls and the Honda Cog ad.
Yeah.
And both of them have been... So there's a question here around, this thing about originality, like how much stuff is original when, we're all an amalgamation of our inputs.
Yeah, totally, totally. And I absolutely agree with that. I don't think there's any such thing as originality. I think what you can do is, but there is a pride moment, which is if you're going to be inspired by somebody or you're going to be, yeah, I suppose the word is inspired or reversioning something, is do it with a little bit of dignity. I mean, there was a famous story of a very famous brand campaign that was done for IKEA, which in the States, which showed people having, you didn't know it was in IKEA, but they were having arguments in their front room or in their bedroom, and then you pulled out and you just went, you know, they're actually in the store. Very funny work, very, very funny work. And then MFI in this country did exactly, exactly the same idea. And it was one of those things where, you know, they would have seen it, guaranteed, because it was out and it had been very, very well publicised in the industry. And they would have just gone, well, it doesn't matter. It ran in the States, doesn't matter. People over here wouldn't have seen it. Now, there's a very good point to that, which is, well, you know, do Oasis, are they just like the Beatles? Yeah, probably, you know. But are they a different era? Yeah, they are a different era. And are they kind of rude, whereas the Beatles were charming? Yeah. But it's still, you know, there are similarities in there, which you can, it's up to the consumer to sit there and judge. But with that thing with Savills, I mean, it was like, for me, it was pretty cut and dried. But you know what? There was never any moment when I wanted to sue them or where I wanted any money. I just wanted them to say sorry.
Yeah.
And it kind of escalated, because then people were, mates of mine on it, or people I knew on Instagram, I didn't even know half of them, were saying, what about this one? And they would then do a very famous, because my point was, well, look, there's loads of other brilliant artists out there. I'm just a shitty little screen printer. What about, you know, Roy Lichtenstein? Imagine if he changed one of his pictures to an ad for Savills. And it just escalated from there. And then people were sending them in to me, and I was just publishing them. And then it only changed when a bloke from the Evening Standard phoned me up one night. I was dropping my kid off playing football, and the phone rang, and I thought it was another one of these like PPI people. And I said, hello. And he was like, hello, yeah, I'm from the Evening Standard. And I was like, oh shit, what's happened now? And he said, what's all this stuff about Savills? And I said, all right. And I explained it to him, and he said, well, how much are you trying to sue him for? And I said, mate, I'm not trying to sue him. I don't want any money. I want chicken. I want Nando's. That's all I wanted. I just said, if you get me Nando's, you get me Nando's for 10 and you buy one of my prints, I'll go away. But they just weren't responding. So I just said, well, fuck it. The longer if you don't respond, I'm just going to keep going, because I can keep going. I've got lots of energy. but also because I am an artist, and also I work in advertising. So I know both sides of the, I know the play, you know, I know how they do it.
Well, let's talk about your art, because, and also on that, I was listening to a really interesting interview on This Week in Startups the other day, and it was with a chap from the Pirate Bay.
Yeah.
And he had this really interesting point, which I don't really know the answer to, which was, he was talking about, if you take a photo, you assume that you have the copyright. But yeah, if I take a photo of your artwork, who owns the copyright?
Yeah.
With your art, this is a slight tangent from what I was just talking about, but why did you get into it? Was it, and also why the maps? I always think sometimes I see people like Damien Hirst, for example, and they do dot paintings, and I go, do you know what? Like, you know, the whole advertising industry, a lot of it's just based around talking a bunch of bullshit. You know, can you just fictitiously like create this image for yourself, which is very easy to do in the online space. You can make yourself whoever you want to be to some degree. And thank you. And it, you know, like, was it a social experiment as much as it was art? You know,
a little bit. I mean, I trained as a graphic designer. I've always made stuff. I used to make clocks out of things I found. I'd get old lumps of wood and I'd chop a hole in it and put a clock face in it. And I used to do a lot of paintings with, when I lived in Spitalfields, I'd find old lumps of wood and pallets and make paintings out of that. So I've done it for a long time. The thing that always used to frustrate me, or the thing I loved about art, is that you can have an idea, you can see something on the street, you can grab it, you can repaint it, repurpose it, make lamps. I used to make lots of lights out of old drum kits, and I'd walk down to Brick Lane Market and see a drum kit and go, fuck, and get it home and then put lights in it and turn it into, and then sell them in shops. And I love that idea of that instant, that kind of spontaneity of creativity, where you could have an idea and then you could sell it really, really quickly. Whereas in advertising, everything takes so long. You know, you need 3 weeks for the planner to write the brief, then you get 3 weeks to think up the idea, then it goes through death by a thousand cuts with the process, and then you end up a year later making something you don't even know what you're doing about it anymore. I mean, it's like, my God. And that's the bloody crappy process that we've created. We could be really, really quick, because when I worked at Channel 4, they're quick. I've worked at national newspapers. Yeah, they respond really fast. You know, they can make a paper in a day. Advertising, we can't even organise a meeting in a day. I can't even organise biscuits in a meeting in a day. And the thing I loved about the art with the screen printing was purely because when I left Karma, I thought, right, I really want to learn how to save a life, sculpt and screen print in that year I'm not allowed to work. Screen printing happened to be the very first thing I did. And I just went, wow, this is great. I rented desk space. And then I just had this mental idea that if I could be a creative and get paid to do it, that's my dream. And looking back, I would go, blimey, you know, the last 3 years I had at Karma Armour, I was just the old grey bloke who they wheeled out and put into meetings with clients who'd go, well, look, this is the founder. Yeah, he's really important. The founder's here. And I thought, fuck, is that my role now? Because I still think I have quite a lot to offer. Above and beyond being the old grey bloke that comes in and goes, hello, everybody, I'm rather old, I'm the founder. Please trust me in when I say that this work is amazing. I was just like, I don't want to do that. I want to sit there and do some work. And I suppose that's one of the issues with the business is that sometimes you promote yourself into oblivion. You know, you just, the more experience you get, some people shouldn't be running companies. Some people should just be really good at being heavy hitters. But there's a weird thing that we keep having to be pushed, and suddenly you find yourself running a company. You shouldn't be doing it.
There's a world now where people are trying to self-fund, get audience funding and that kind of thing. Have you looked into it? Patreon and that kind of stuff.
How do you mean?
There's websites where you say, you know, I want to pursue art. This is my art. Do you like my art? If you do, how about you donate £1 a month? I'll do.
Blimey, no, I never even knew about that. I mean, I suppose in a way, that's kind of the process I went through with the print club stuff. Is I remember going upstairs to the because I come from, you know, an advertising background. You have a real discipline. You know, a brief is written. You work out who your audience is. You look at that. You look at every aspect of it, and then you create a piece of work that's going to appeal to yourself, and then also an audience with a response that you kind of want them to garner. I went to the gallery owner at Print Club, which is just where I happened to start printing. You know, I hadn't printed in like 30 years when I was at college. I'd done it, but I mean, I never really did it. I just learned how to do it. I didn't have any style, and I said to her, "Go on, tell me what sells." And she told me that there was. You know, people really like parrots and people really... And there's one artist who does pineapples and he does a lot of stuff. He sells a lot of work. And I was like, wow, pineapples and parrots.
Do a parrot on a pineapple.
Yeah, that would really sell. Or a parrot or a pineapple on a parrot. Either way, it would sell. And I was a little bit kind of... I was a little bit disappointed because I thought, you know, they're beautiful pictures of parrots and the stuff he prints pineapple, they look fucking cool. But... I've always worked in a business, you know, again, groomed by Steve Henry, who's sitting in the back of my head going, why is it different? Why is that going to cut through? And I suppose I've been groomed to create creativity that gets a reaction. So that if it's on TV or if it's a poster, that people are going to stop minimum and then look at it minimum or listen to it minimum and then respond to it in some way. If I'm not doing that, it's a failure. Now, the whole idea of hanging a picture of a parrot on my wall filled me with dread because I just thought, why would I do it? I mean, I like parrots, I like pineapples, but do I want a picture of a parrot on my wall? Does that say what I want it to, you know, if you get somebody back to your house and they go, yeah, he's got a parrot on his wall, he's got pineapple in his bathroom. What does that say about me? It just says he's kind of, you know, he's all right, really. He's got nice stuff. And so I said to her, you know, tell me what sells. And she told me, and then I thought, and then she said, what kind of stuff do you do? And I'd just done a print of a four colour picture of some dogs that I found. It's called Bad Dog, and I did two of them, and they're just pictures of these little dogs in French with their names in French. It's called Vilain Chien, and I just thought it was a funny thing to do. Four colour, which means, you know, you print cyan, you know, yellow, cyan, magenta, black, but they've all got erections. And you don't notice it at first. I'll give you one because I've never sold one. But I remember I said to her, I print pictures of dogs. She went, oh, yeah, dogs. People like dogs. I said, it's four colour. And she went, yeah. And she looked at it and she went, yeah, they're... Because I'd only been printing about a month. And she said, yeah. They're not really that good, are they? And I said, I know. And then she went, ooh, and dropped it. And she said, why have they all got erections? I said, because it's funny. It's funny. Now, I don't know anybody that thinks about doing a print that's funny. Most prints are just done to look on the wall and you go, oh, that's nice. Whereas I was just sort of thinking, if you can make it funny, that's funny, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so I started doing more stuff like that. And then I sort of noticed, and then it was just by complete chance that I did the maps. And I went down to an old antique shop and I saw a load of these blue folded maps. I thought, what are they? And I opened it up and they're beautiful. And they're kind of printed on paper that's then backed with linen. And I thought, well, I wonder what I could do with these. What if I got, you know, a map of, and I bought five maps and one was like Gloucestershire. And then I looked online, I thought, I wonder if I could find a joke about, one was Newcastle. And I said, any funny jokes about Newcastle? And there was one said, what's the difference between a kangaroo and a kangaroot? A kangaroo is a marsupial found in Australia, and a kangaroo is what a Geordie shouts when he's stuck in the lift. And so I printed that joke on the map. I only did one of each map and joke, and they all sold. And I think, I was like, oh, okay, this is quite interesting, because I'm printing onto something that's, like, when you start with a blank bit of paper, you've got to kind of try and create something that you think people are going to like. Whereas when you print onto something else, the thing I get obsessed by is, There's already enough shit in the world. You don't have to keep making new stuff. Like, I only like driving secondhand cars. I want to live in an old house. I don't buy secondhand clothes because I'm not that tight. But I like the idea of that something having giving it a bit of a afterlife. And so all the stuff now it's just become a terrible obsession with my OCD working overtime, is that I only print onto things that I find. So it might be a sheet of metal, or it might be playing cards, or dollar bills, or maps.
That's going to come at you with the Savills debate, isn't it?
Well, yeah. But the thing, I thought I'd get into trouble with it, with the maps, and printing onto pages of old like Ladybird books. But the way I look at it is, I've already paid for it.
Yeah.
So Ladybird, you got your money. Now, what I choose to do with it, if I choose to use print, it as toilet print paper, it, or print something on it, or just put it on a shelf, that's entirely up to me. If people then choose to buy it, well, that's entirely up to them. But the transaction between you and me has already happened.
Yeah.
And so I kind of squared that up. I mean, I'm using their thing. You know, I'm using their thing, but I'm kind of giving it a little... I suppose it is. It's the same argument. But they never tried that.
Yeah.
And well, I got chicken,
dog,
so hey.
Dog with an erection on it. It's completely
well,
different.
Well, they're funny. It's a nice print. I say it's a nice print. I've got one on the wall, A little kid came in to see my kids, and they were like, little doggy. And then they went, oh, mummy. And then she went, oh. And then you saw the mum trying to explain to a two-year-old child why they've all got little dicks out. And it was just, it was really embarrassing, but made me laugh.
I was going to say that throughout your kind of career, to some degree, you'd like to be an anarchist.
Mm.
And if it's okay with you, I'd like to share some quotes that I found particularly amusing.
Where have you been finding all this stuff?
I've been doing my research. It's what you're supposed to do with these things.
Okay.
So you said you couldn't earn enough as an artist to sustain your huge blow habit. Which I thought was a good one.
Yeah.
You said you were very happy at CP&B unless someone was prepared to pay you more money, which I thought was interesting that you were. And then finally you said... you stopped worrying about client meetings because at the end of the day, worst case scenario, if you could beat them up, you'd be fine.
No. That's I don't know where you got that one from. I've got a theory that this whole thing of the relationship that you're into, which is you're having to do this kind of smoke and mirrors moment when at the end of the day, you're going to try and give a piece of work to somebody and you're hoping they're going to buy it. And you have to do a little bit of a con man moment where you have to kind of convince them that it's the right thing, and they have to trust you. And sometimes if you're older, it makes it easier, and if you're really well respected, it makes it easier. And if you're, you know, if you've got an interesting haircut or a nice coloured suit, it makes, you know, there are lots of little things. You become a little bit of a magician.
Yeah.
And your job is to sit there and make somebody engage with something. And often they don't really want to engage with it because they don't like you very much. They don't like your agency. They don't like what you do. You're a bit of a pain in the arse, And historically, you've treated them quite badly because that's what the industry has done to a lot of our clients. So I always have this sort of funny game in the back of my head, which is when I go into a meeting, I used to sit there and think, if I had to, could I kill this person if I got into a fight with them? Could I kill them? Because I used to sometimes be quite intimidated by people. I'm not very confident. And I think a lot of the time, certainly in the early part of my career, I was quite shy. And you would sort of think, God, it's terrifying going in and presenting work and having to memorise all the words. It's like being in a play. And when you do a pitch and it's like, and then we did this. And then have to laugh in the right place and then segue into somebody else. I hate that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Absolutely hate it. And you look at clients and they would just be yawning, going, oh, God, these idiots from London. Look what they're doing now. So I used to just play this game with myself, which is, if it came to it, could I kill you? And it always made me suddenly just go, ah, fuck it, if I can kill him, what am I worried about? Because if it comes to it, the worst thing that's going to happen is there's going to be a fight. And if I know I can kill him, easy day. It's happy days. This is going to sound dreadful.
No. It's actually interesting because when I heard it, it played into this little philosophy I've got on my own. And this takes it into a lot more serious kind of gender debate thing, which I don't necessarily want to get into. But there's one chap who I've worked for, a guy called Alex Asaley. He used to be the founder of Jawbone, the speakers and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
This guy is like a Stanford educated. His brother was involved in Skype. Very, very smart guy.
Yeah.
He's also 6'3" and like a burly beast of a man.
Yeah.
And he's the only person who like basically made me feel like a child again when I was working for him. And
and
I analysed it, and all my bosses, I've tried to talk to them as just normal people, as I would a friend. Hopefully they treat me with respect as opposed to like this authority figure or whatever. But with him, I've always felt like one of his underlings, do you know what I mean? And I analysed it and I was like, it's because this man could kill me.
Yeah.
And I feel like that subconscious power thing is still...
Well, I think it always helps. I mean, I know it's going to sound really, really primal, but I think it does help. If you're a big bloke or you've got something about you, your personality is bigger. You know, when I said at the beginning of the conversation, I think that the business is like 95% of it donkeys and the other 5% are tigers. And, you look at generals in the army and you go, fuck me, I'd follow that bloke into hell and high water. He's on a white horse. He's got, like, ivory handles on his gun and he's smoking a fag. I'll do it. You know, do you remember that brilliant scene of the kind of the general in Apocalypse Now? He's kind of walking around on the beach while they're being shot at and they're going surfing. There's a kind of mentality that you want to, I think leaders, and it's at every level. I don't mean just the people who are leading the company. I mean, at every level, there will be people in the organisation who you find yourself magnetically drawn towards because you think, wow, they've just, whether it's just a confidence or they've got a swagger or they've just got the ability to be nice to people and they can, sometimes they're ass kickers, sometimes they're huggers, but they have the ability to sort of make people feel special. Now, that guy that you're talking about, 6'3", because you're working for him, you feel that he can crush you, and he probably could. But also, there's probably a moment when he looks at you and goes, my role as his boss is also to be his mentor, to look after him, to father him in some way or mother him in some way, so that you're there to try and build them up and help them. And then, when they want to go off and be brilliant somewhere else, you let them do that. And I think that that's one of the really important roles in the business we use the phrase, mercenary versus missionary, but I think that we're not very missionary in the way that we interact with our staff. We don't look after our people as, considering they're our only asset, we don't look after them at all. And I think that kind of the analogy of me thinking that it's, I can relax and enjoy my life more because I know I can kill the person I'm presenting to, is probably just a sort of oversimplified way of breaking it down to the end of the day, he wants something, I might have something, and if I can just relax into it and be a normal person about it by just shedding all of that bullshit that when we become corporate we kind of instigate and it becomes a play and an act and you have to dress a certain way and you have to say things a certain way, you know what, life is way too short for that, and I just want to kind of work with some nice people, have as much fun as possible and do as much good stuff as possible. And if I can do that by being myself and not having to change myself to be somebody else's vision of what I should be, then I'll happily do that.
In the final segment of the interview, I wanted to find out how Dave's experiences have shaped his outlook in life. As someone who has had such a varied and exciting career path, I imagine that he'd have many opportunities to refine his philosophies when it comes to the creative pursuit and living a meaningful life. And I wanted to see if he would open up about some of the more aspirational and emotional aspects of being a creative person.
There was something interesting that you said earlier on about... I can't remember we were talking about it. It led me to think about something that I remember when I was at Channel 4. Channel 4, they had a really, really interesting structure, employment structure. You weren't paid. You would sign up for a 2-year contract, which I thought was a really interesting way of working. So imagine, you know, you're 22, you get a job in an agency and you sign a 2-year gig. So you suddenly have a 2-year window where you can work out how badly you want to stay, what you want to achieve. There's a hurdle moment, which is at the end of the first year, the end of the first 6 months, second 6 months, third 6 months, you can kind of go, right, these are the things as an individual within that organisation I want to try and achieve. Whereas in advertising, you're just hired, and then after 2 years or 18 months, you either decide to fuck off, and or after 3 years or after 10 years, you're made redundant or you're fired or whatever. And one of the things I loved about Four was treating it like a college, so that I think you sort of mentioned it. I can't remember how you said it, but it was perfect, because you go there and you use what you've learned in one place and roll that into what you do in your next place. And I think that's a hugely valuable part of our progression as creative individuals, that you're inspired by different places, by different people, even 6'3" people who you're terrified of, but you're inspired from it. And you'll use that experience to then become better or try something different at another place. And I think it's that mentality of almost treating it like a kind of a period of education as you go there. And I always thought that I always wanted to try and do that with any businesses I set up, is have a kind of 2-year contract that you just go, you just sign it.
I think back in the day, at Saatchi & Saatchi, they tried to implement almost like a football model whereby people would sign a contract and then it'd be like, oh, if you want to buy them, then
you transfer, you pay us some money. Great idea. Yeah. But I think it's a really interesting idea, because then they are your asset. But we've kind of created this business that is very flabby, and it kind of, it's too easy. And we sort of, you know, half the things that we do, we could do in a quarter of the time. But we've sort of, it's in our interest to take as long as possible, because that's how we make our money, or that's how we judge ourselves, and that's how we get paid by our clients. And so you've got this thing where everything is just vanilla, and no one's worried.
To your point around hopping from one place and taking away lessons, I mean, there was this seminal moment in my life when I was younger, and basically I'd broke up with a girlfriend, and I started reading about psychology and how to chat up girls and stuff. And what I learned from that was,
you know what you got to do? You just got, if you think you can kill them in a fight.
Yeah, that's always a good thing.
But they're very dangerous.
But it taught me about how that actually applied to psychology, and how it could be more personable, and how, to your point around personality, is a big thing and is a magnet towards you. And that's how I learned about books. And then from books, I learned by learning about different subjects that I could pull that into what I was doing creatively.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, to some degree, you're quite close to where I am in the world, but off other weeks we interview people from completely different places.
Yeah.
And we can really pull insights and go, you know, how can we apply this knowledge to what we're doing now?
Yeah.
And that's just a healthy way to be, I believe. And if you maintain that curiosity.
Well, that's quite an intelligent way of doing it. I mean, if you don't mind me blowing smoke up your ass, that's a very intelligent way of doing it, because that kind of shows some level of maturity, that it's like, you know, I am genuinely interested in listening to people from all diverse ways of working and diverse backgrounds, because that might actually make me better. Now, most people in advertising think that they are already geniuses. And that's one of its failings, I suppose, is that we have been groomed to think that we're the smartest people in the room, and we're not. And I think anything that we can do in order to help us become smarter or more informed or more interesting has got to be a good thing. But again, it's just that weird thing. Is like, it's just a very male trait, which is, once we feel like we've achieved anything, then that's what we do. We just kind of, we milk that. And I've seen it happen to so many great agencies. You know, Hal Henry was a brilliant agency at the time when it was constantly challenging. And then the minute it became a little bit too, it kind of achieved quite a lot of things, it sat back, and then it just employed lots of people who were quite happy to go there and go, oh, you know, I'll go there to do the next Maxell ad, or I'll go there to do the next Tango ad, rather than, I'll go, you know, they were there for selfish reasons rather than, I want to go there and fucking just reinvent it. That's what people should be doing.
I think it's a bit of a lazy segue, but What I've noticed is that a lot of my friends, myself included, so when I was in my early 20s, I just went through an extremely bad period of severe anxiety and depression.
Yeah.
And it was all entangled in...
Were you working in the business at the time?
I was, yeah, and I was...
And what was driving that, do you think?
I was working extremely late hours. I had very high aspirations.
Yeah.
I'd achieved all my aspirations within 6 months of being in the industry, and I didn't really know where to go next. All of the things that I thought were going to come out of it, I won an international award, and it was like, well done, Rick. And then the next day, my life was exactly the same. And I was just like, right, okay, what am I doing?
What am I supposed to be? Yeah, what's the point?
And yeah, and also being very self-aware, being like, you know, I'm going to die one day. I don't, what the fuck am I doing this or whatever? Yeah. And still to this day, I have those thoughts. And I think as a creative person, you go through peaks and troughs. But I seem to notice that... a lot of young people, when they transition into the industry, go through it, and it's like I've seen it with multiple people. Some of whom struggle much worse than others.
Yeah.
Myself, I being like a very personal development type individual, you know, I started yoga, I started doing meditation, all this stuff, and I took away some things from that, and in order to make sure it's not an ongoing thing for me, but.
Yeah.
Have you ever been through those kind of things?
Absolutely.
And also, you know, how have you learned to deal with them? Because you're quite you love a rant, and you get. I can imagine that you probably sometimes go, "Oh, what the fuck am I doing?"
You know what? It's weird. I mean, I think Pete. It's one of those things because my outlet at the moment is written word on a computer or on a blog post or on Instagram. I don't think I'm a ranter. So I was thinking, it's just, I'm sort of doing it very, very tongue-in-cheek, but it's one of those things that when you read emails or you read posts, sometimes it's very difficult to read. You have to kind of write extra stuff in there to make sure that people know you're taking the piss.
Yeah.
And, you know, my thing is, I take the piss. I mean, it's like, you know, that Trivago poster was more of a piss take because it is just so dreadful. I mean, it's like, it's not even trying to analyse it. I mean, it's like looking at something that's just meaningless. But it was there to make a point. It's weird. I mean, back to your point about kind of confidence and sort of, you know, the sort of the stability of the mind and also the fragility of the mind. I mean, you know, when I was I'm extraordinarily shy, very, very shy, have a huge amount. It takes me a long time to get a confidence where I sort of think I'm of value. And I don't know if that's something that just happens when you get older. I don't think it's something that happens when you become successful. I have no idea what success means. You know, it's like, I don't think it's about money. I don't think it's about what kind of car you drive. I don't think it's about any sort of achievements. I think it's about, it becomes a kind of knowing in you that you kind of think, yeah, I'm all right.
I know you're going to continue, but just to interject it for a second, the reason I thought I'd ask you this is because by people in the advertising standards, you've set up and grown... what would many consider to be a successful agency.
Yeah.
You've done lots of great work. You've effectively like hit the ceiling of what is our industry, like metaphorically. Maybe you feel like there's a lot more to come or whatever.
Yeah.
But I believe that maybe you hit that and then it's in the similar way that how I ticked off my to-do list and gone, oh, fuck, you know, what do I do next? Does the same thing happen?
It's difficult. I don't even know what my to-do list is. I mean, it's like, I don't think I've ever had a plan. You know, I had a weird thing when I was 14. I died. I had an accident where I was found hanging off the stairs at home. Sort of have no idea what happened. You know, the ambulance came in and went, he's dead. My mum went, no, he fucking isn't. Get him going again. And they kind of got me going again. I went into spasm, went into a coma. I was in a coma for about 10 days. Came out. Now, that has never really affected me, but it has affected me in a way which I just sort of think, wow, man, I could easily have not been here. And so squeaking every fucking molecule of fun out of anything is really important to me. I don't drink. I don't do drugs. I don't do any of that shit. I don't cheat.
So is all your blow comments, is that all just a joke?
It's just a joke. I've never done cocaine. Never done it.
It's funny.
If people always sort of say to me, oh, God, you know, you must be really pleased about that deal with Accenture. And I'm like, yeah, man, I made so much money, I can now build furniture out of cocaine. And they're like, Dave.
Yeah.
Well, I've never touched the stuff. All the wankers I know do it. I mean, it's just, you know, I've worked in an industry where it's riddled with drug abuse and booze abuse. Never done any. I don't do either. It's not because I've got a problem. I mean, I like driving cars and riding motorbikes, and either of those two things don't make it work. And so I've just had this, it's a total piss take. And for me, there is a huge fragility in the mind, which is, you know, and I go through it now. I'm fucking 53. I've been in the business a long time. But I still do it. You know, if I have a bad day at the office, I'll go home and I'll feel really shit. And I'll go, God, man, you know, they didn't like that piece of work we did. In fact, you know, last week we presented a bit of work to a client and she was kind of underwrought and underwhelmed by it. And I just kind of walked out and went, fuck, you know, should I even be doing this anymore? And then the following day you do a piece of work that somebody loves and you go, yeah! And it's like that. You know, my life is like that. It's just complete up and down. But when you cram all of those up and downs into a short space of time, you end up with a nice band, and it's, at least it's interesting. You know, I know a lot of other people who are just super bland. They go on the motorway, they do 45 all the way to the coast, and it's all happy day. It's easy. But it's just not the way I've been cut out.
You like a bit of turbulence.
Well, I don't know whether I like it or whether I attract it or whether it's just something that I go for or whether it just happens to me. I like to think, I mean, as one of my favourite sayings is, smooth seas don't make great sailors. And I think that if you are the kind of person that can handle that kind of shit, somebody, if there is somebody playing chess with you, they will just constantly put you in that situation. You know, I had a wonderful job at CPP. I was getting paid very nicely. I'd had, you know, pretty, you know, to be the, you know, creative director or chief creative officer, whatever the hell that is, at an agency like CPP, which is going to go through amazing changes now that they're doing the thing with F&B, Forsman & Bodenfors in Sweden, who are a fantastic agency. You know, it's like, man, I just jumped out of one of the nicest aeroplanes there is, you know, with no parachute. People must think I'm absolutely mental. I think I'm fucking mental, but I still did it. And I did it with somebody else who I think is totally mental. And he must be looking at me as we're falling, just going, Dave, you're a head case. Why have we done this? But I think that there's something else out there.
And you'll go to the grave going, my life wasn't boring.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's, you know, whether it was the thing I had when I was 14 when I died, or whether it was when I hit 50 and I just thought, man, I'm running out of time. And I just think, if I could, you know, what are you going to be remembered for? I don't want to be remembered for work. I don't want to be remembered for creating businesses that employed lots and lots of people that made them laugh. I just want to be remembered.
Hopefully, a dog with an erection.
A dog with an erection. Yeah. Or being the biggest dog ass puncher in South London.
Just to like counter that point a little bit, I had a similar experience. So I had a brain bleed when I was at uni.
Okay, how old are you?
21. No, wow. I was 20 and it was turning 21.
Shit.
And
what happened?
I had a malformation. It was in the gym and basically I burst a vessel. Wow. And so I had to have gamma knife treatment, which is basically where they...
Gamma what?
Gamma knife. Basically, it was either brain surgery or this like cutting edge laser treatment. And because of my age, they offered me that. Thankfully, I wasn't in America because it would have cost me like $100,000 or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, they screw this cage onto your scalp. And there's a few things I think analysing myself as to why I'm incredibly driven, but sometimes, to your point about fun, like ever since then I've appreciated every day. Hmm. And
how old are you now?
27.
Shit, so it's really quite recent.
Yeah, but I've kind of lived to an extremely unhealthy, you know, fun doesn't really come into my life very often.
Right.
And it's something I'm really working on. Like the chap in there, Ollie Mills, who's in the other room for people listening, like he's just a joker, you know. Like he was telling me all the jokes I should say to you on the way here, you know. And I need to surround myself with people like that. But just I'm saying this for the people listening to go, you know, some people turn it into fun, some people turn it into what I've turned it into, which is getting up at 5 a.m, going to bed at 10, and just like working. You know, and it's unhealthy.
It is, but, you know, let's not forget that we are professional and we have a role to play. We're a service. Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that we seem to forget in the business is that we think we're the organ grinder. We're not, we're the monkeys. We're employed by people to help them win. And what they do is they use our expertise, and so we're professionals. And I remember it kind of reminded me, I don't like Arsenal, but I always use this as an example. I remember when Arsene Wenger came over, English football teams would still have a cigarette at half time and a cup of tea and a pie and then a punch up in the evening. Whereas when he came along, he just went, no, you're professionals. Eat pasta, because if you eat pasta before a game, it'll help you run longer and it'll give you more energy. Now, you just sort of think applying science and a bit of rigour and professionalism to your career isn't a bad thing. Now, we're moderately lucky in comparison to footballers who might have a lifespan, a career span of about 10 to 20 years if they're lucky. With a brain, without having a bleed at the age of 21, you could have a long career where you could still be using your brain consistently. And the good thing is, when you look at AI and all that kind of stuff that's coming in to replace the brain, it will never happen, because I think the human brain is a much more powerful engine and computer than anything that could ever be created. I think it'd be very good at creating Trivago ads, but we don't want any more of those. And so I think that there's a professionalism, which, that's why I've never done coke. That's why, I've been drunk before. I've done stupid things before, but I don't do it now. I think that there's something, I like the idea of, maybe it's a very Italian thing as well, being not losing control. But I was also, given a job to be creative director when I was 28. So I was very, very young. You suddenly find yourself, myself and Naresh, working at Chai Day, running an agency where you had to sit in meetings. And, when you were told to get in for a 9 o'clock meeting, you were in there at 8:45, 8:40, 8:30. You didn't turn up at 10 and go, sorry, I was out on the piss last night. It just doesn't, you have to set an example. And I took it very seriously. And I was just like, right, you don't fuck the staff. You don't do drugs. And if you go out on the piss, you do it harder and longer than anybody. And then you're in way earlier than everybody. And you have to look indestructible. So they just look at you and they go, shit, man, he's indestructible. I can count on him. Well, after doing that for about 2 weeks, I just thought, my God, if I don't do it, it's easier. And so you just, you treat it like a profession. And I think, don't worry about working hard. If you have got ambitions to run an agency, to run a department, to build a business in whatever respect you want to do, I think that that grounding of being a professional is step number one. If you've got talent, if you can be a professional, work really fucking hard, and that will outplay talent half the time.
Well, it's to your point there, I think, to extract a little bit, I've been thinking about this recently, that actually one of the first things that you need to do as a professional is to build trust. And if you're reliable,
yeah,
and deliver consistently or whatever, and people know in the hard times you're going to be there, you're not fucking around.
Well, I used to work with a guy who, you go, let's have a meeting at 9. He would turn up at 8:59:59, and he'd be there. Now, he'd turn up, technically he was on time, but he'd then spend 10 minutes twatting about, talking about all the stuff he'd been doing the night before. Now, I'm the total opposite. If I've got a meeting at 9, I'll be there at 6:30. Because I would have worried about, and this is OCD, but I would have worried about, what if the train's late, or what if my bike breaks down? This morning I had a meeting but get there at 8:30, the meeting starts at 9, but we're doing it's a presentation, so you'd have to sort of sit through, we'd get to, I was there at 8:15, and I walked in, she was like, what are you doing here? I said, I'm sorry, I'm just here early. But I would rather be three hours early than 30 seconds late, because it's just, you cannot ever get respect. Like you're saying, minimum you need respect off the people who are paying you. If you turn up late, you're just an idiot. Your staff have to look at you and go, you are a worthy leader. You're the person that I will follow into battle, because not only are you be there on time, but you're professional enough to understand. If you're good on top of being on time, wow. If you're a nice person as well as being good, as well as being on time, even bigger wow. And that's all you've got to do. And I think, having those kind of, there is a slight mentality about the business. It's just one big old Roman orgy. And it used to be. And even when you go to Cannes, it still is. But it's such a pointless part of the industry. The industry is, we are employed by people to help them win. And fucking hell, God forbid, be professional. Turn up on time and do the fucking job you're supposed to do, but do it 20 times better than they're expecting, and then charge them 20 times more. that's what I think, the mentality of make money. If you're delivering if you're a plumber or you're a brain surgeon, well, the brain surgeon deserves more money, because maybe he's better.
Agreed. I'm gonna throw some quick fire questions at you before we get into some of the very, very final questions. So, favourite film or documentary?
Oh, wow. I love documentaries and I like films. God, favourite documentary. I don't know. Okay. I mean, I literally, you know, I've just watched. When I'm working, I always have something on in the corner. I'm not even watching it, but it's kind of there, like Company, so that I can just I'll put my headphones on and I'll just work. But I need to have some sound. Just watched a very good series called Top of the Lake, China Girl, which is pretty gruesome, pretty dark, but it's good. But then, you know, I loved The Ozark. Really like that.
There you go. There's a few recommendations.
Yeah, Ozark's very good.
Book or learning resource?
Learning resource. I mean, the internet is
it's pretty, a good one.
Pretty faultless and faultful. I mean, it's
haven't discovered that one yet. Then check that one out.
Books. I'm not a massive reader.
No.
I have to say, when I go on holiday, I mean, I'm a doer, and I can't. And reading just feels a little bit passive to me. I like to kind of make shit. And I'm kind of saying about books. I'm actually trying to write a book at the minute, but I don't even know what it's about. I mean, it's, you know, half of it is this sort of stuff. You know, half of it is the bullshit things that have happened in my career, and then maybe some theories about stuff, and then some cookery and interesting recipes. but like I said, I'm not a massive reader. I don't like sort of business books or anything like that. I like to kind of watch programs or listen to people talking. It feels a lot easier for me.
A newsletter people should subscribe to.
Well, obviously, Real Hackney Dave on Instagram, I think, is invalid. Blimey. There's a... I don't know. God, you fucking... I don't know.
Trying to bleed you dry of resource.
I don't know. I love... Again, it's a sort of... There's a kind of... I'm not very good at hunting out stuff, but I love to be told stuff. And so I'm always open to anything.
Subscribe to my newsletter then.
Well, yeah. but you know what it is? It sort of gets back to that thing of reading. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if it's just something I'm not very good at. But listening to people.
Yeah.
I've got a weird...
So who's the favourite person you like to listen to? I know you're a fan of Dave Trott, aren't you?
Dave Trott, yeah. I mean, Dave Trott was certainly somebody that, you know, when I started in the business, he was running, you know, without a doubt, the best agency. The bloke that I was working with lived in a house with all the people that worked at GGT at the time, all Geordie, mental Geordies. And I've never met Dave. I mean, I've met Dave two or three occasions. I've met his kids on two or three occasions. I used to, in fact, when I worked at WCRS, I was sharing an office. And I don't think she was very fond of me at the time, with Kathy Heng, Dave's wife. We just ended up sitting on her sofa, and she used to look at us in a very... didn't like us. We just didn't understand what we were doing sitting in her office, which I would have done. But I have a lot of... You know, he's... What I like about him is he's not afraid to say what he thinks.
And, it's a no-bullshit kind
of
person.
And I love that.
Yeah.
And I think the reason I struggle with a lot of business books is that business books are written by people who are... trying to spout off about how smart they are, but never really come to a conclusion or a kind of anything that is feels. It sort of always feels retrospective. I remember when I worked at Channel 4, somebody came up and said, "Oh, you used to work at St. Luke's," and I was like, "Yeah, yeah." She said, "I read the book. Oh my God, just amazing! That book is a work of fiction. It shouldn't, you know, the book that was written about that in that agency was nothing like what the agency was about. It was written as a work of fiction." But people believe all that shit. And what I like about...
I think you're very good at that, actually, at, like, planting little fictitious seeds that people like to believe.
Well, it's sadly, it's really easy.
Yeah.
You know, I got 28 O-levels, 3 A-levels. No, I didn't. I didn't get anything.
You are fake news.
I'm totally fake man.
Yeah.
And I just think it's like there's a game that you can play. And, you know, I don't want my persona. I want my persona... which is at the moment, but with people who don't know me, is probably on Instagram. But I want them to know that's what I'm like, and I'll have an opinion about anything, but try and make it a bit piss-takey.
All right, this is supposed to be quick-fire, but I'll ask you this last one anyway. On that, because you're so right, you can make people believe stuff. So why go cocaine and this kind of stuff rather than... I've got MIT degree.
Because anybody knows me knows I'm unbelievably boring.
Yeah.
You know, I don't do any of that stuff. At work, you know, at CPB, I'll be at home at, you know, if there was a Christmas party, I'd be at home at 10. I'm just not that interesting. But the thing I get a huge amount of interest, the thing that drives me is making stuff. And you know, I'll be at home at 10, but I'll be screen printing at 6 in the morning while everybody else is stumbling out of some horrible club with a load of Chang up their hooter. You know, just don't do it. And I love all the things that a lot of other people don't. And I hate all the things that a lot of other people love. So for me, it's like I can just play that. You know, it's probably sounds so stupid, and it's not done to make me to make people think that I'm cool that I do cocaine. But it's like anybody that knows me will know I've never ever done it, and I don't drink. So it's like I just take the take the piss. It's kind of more fun.
I'm gonna try this. I'm gonna create a little. See if people can spot.
It's weird. One of the kids, my son had a birthday party, and this girl came up, and she's provocative. She was like 9, and she went, "Dave, have you ever done PCP?" And I just looked at her and went, "Yeah." And I know that she walked away from that and went, "Fuck, he's done PCP." If I'd gone, any normal adult, any self-respecting adult, parent would have gone, "Oh my God." How, they would have talked to their parents. How do you even know about PCP? You're 9 years old. Of course I've never done it. It's a disgusting drug. It's the kind of thing you should never, ever do. And because I looked at her and just went, yeah, and then said nothing else, I know she walked away from that thinking I've done PCP. I've never done PCP. But it made her... It's like that thing of, if I know I can kill you in a meeting, then I feel all right. If you think that I've done PCP, that means you're weak. Or you think I'm stronger than you, and then it's pathetic. You've completely dismantled me. It's going to be one of these things where I'm just going to have to go and have therapy now.
You're the king of gullible people. It's great.
Well, but in a way, that's what we do in advertising.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that's our job, is to sit there and sell people.
Yeah.
And if you can sell them a vision that... You know, I remember we had a meeting once with a client at B&Q. And she came in and she went, they were kind of trying to find out if we were nice people. And she said, "Dave, I've heard these stories that somebody told me a story that you threw a billiard ball at somebody." I went, "Never done that. Never done that." And I went, who told you that? Probably the other agency have said, "Oh, Dave Bonagui, he's a fucking lunatic. He's got furniture made out of cocaine. He's a lunatic. Throws billiard balls at people." I've never done anything like that. But if you keep... If you kind of propagate that myth, or you tell them that you did something, they just make it up. I mean, it's like the world is full of idiots that you can just, or people that don't mind having a bit of a laugh. You know, when I went out and said the chairman of Savills has given me all of his jazz mags, or his favourite jazz mags, some people believed that. Now, some people would have read that and gone, "Oh, well, that's funny." But some people genuinely believe that. Why? I mean, does it? Yeah, you know, what kind of world do we live in when you think that the chairman of a big property company is giving me his pornos? It's mental.
Before I ask you the final question and reveal how people can get hold of you, I'm going to pass the show over to our producer, Adam, who's going to share some actual insights from our interview today.
Well, thanks for joining us, David, and thank you for your insight and honesty. Here's 5 actionable insights that I caught as you were talking. Number 1. Challenge making beige vanilla work. It creates a much more interesting universe for creatives and clients. Number 2, use any opportunity to get people talking. The medium doesn't matter. It could be a beer map. Keep going until you find an original angle. Number 3, as a creative person, you're looking to solve problems. Data can help because what we do is like a science. Number 4, be a challenger. The industry needs more of them. More entrepreneurs, more shit kickers who ask why things are done the way they are. Number 5, life is short. Don't waste any time with your talent and energy. Being creative is a wonderful thing to have and you should use it. Find out what you want to use it for. If you can't do it for someone else, then do it for yourself. And number 6, a bonus one, something we would certainly endorse. Listening to people from different backgrounds talking about what they do can help you become a smarter, more informed person.
Thank you, Adam. Some really great insights there. So to sum up, before I ask you the final question, where can people get hold of you, and do you have any asks for the audience?
Good question. You can get hold of me on Instagram, Real Hackney Dave. Just message me. You can email me, davidbonaguidi@gmail.com. I'll give you my mobile number, but I have fucking hundreds of people every day calling me, telling me that about the accident that I had or the incident that I created.
Where they're trying to get insurance.
I don't want it. Dick pic. I don't need any more dick pics. What was the second part of that?
Any asks? Getting
in touch with me is really, really easy.
Okay.
I've got no filter. I don't. I mean, is that in Unlimited Inc., it's me and Arjun Singh. There are two of us. There are no PAs blocking. If you can get my number, give us a call. I'll answer it.
Got it.
What's the other one? Advice for?
No. Asks for the audience.
Ask for the audience. My only ask is if you're in advertising or you're in the creative industry, and interestingly, I think that we are sort of similar peas in the same pod. We have the same sort of frustration. We have the same thing that drives us. And my thing would be, don't waste any time. My ask would be, do something with your energy and your talent. It, for me, being creative is a wonderful, wonderful... I used to sort of call it a curse, but it's a wonderful thing to have. It's a wonderful thing. And you should use it and find out what it is you really want to use it for. I think that's one of the things that in advertising, we sort of get into it and then go, oh, why is it not as interesting as I thought it would be? Well, it's because it's not a very interesting business and it's not creative. It genuinely is not a creative business. My ask would be, please work out what it is you really enjoy and then work out a way of doing it as quickly as you can. And don't worry about what you think advertising should be. Advertising will always kind of, it will continue to exist, but I don't think it's a very stimulating business for genuinely creative people. And if you are genuinely creative, please go out and do something that really inspires you and makes you feel great about the talent you've got. And make sure you use it as quickly as possible because life is very, very short. You know, you had your little moment at 21 and you're 26 now. You know, wouldn't it be nice if you're still doing this when you're 65? Well, I'm 53, so I'm closer to 65 than you're ever going to be. And it's like, you know, I've got the same energy and drive that you have, which makes me feel good because I sort of think, good, you know, I'm glad I haven't given up. You know, I've made some money, you know, but I'm by no stretch of the imagination minted. You know, everything I've had to do has been hand fucking drawn. And that's a very, very painful way of doing it. But you know what? I wouldn't change anything. I'm perfectly happy the choices I've made, perfectly happy. And I think the thing that drives me is just keeping it, trying to keep interested. And if you can't keep interested working for somebody else, then do it yourself and make sure you're stimulating yourself. And make the most of the, you know, it is back making the most of the talent you've got, but also making the most of the time you've got. It's not very long. You know, if you've got kids, you haven't got kids?
No.
You know, when you have kids, man, it's like somebody walked past the old DVD player and hit fast forward. I mean, it just goes. And, you know, days just blend into years. And suddenly you find, fuck, you know, I'm 53. What have I done? What is it? I don't even know what I'm doing. And I think that's one of the things that's back to your confidence thing. And your mentality. I've been through exactly what you've been through, and I'm probably still going through it. But you have that constant thing of like, what the fuck am I doing? What am I doing, and why am I doing it? And in London, it's very easy to get suckered into. Well, I'm doing it, so I've got a good LinkedIn, and I'm doing it for the followers, or I'm doing it for the subs, or I'm doing it for the money, or I'm doing it for the car, or the job, or whatever. And that's not what you're doing it for. There's something in your brain that is there to make you happy, and your happiness is paramount. You know, if you're going out with somebody and you don't like them for whatever reason, you stop. But we often find ourselves doing things that we don't want to do, and then, you know, gradually that becomes something that we do as a career. We're doing something we don't want to do a lot of the time, and then there is nothing more depressing or nothing more able to give you a depression than finding out that you've dedicated your life to something that you don't enjoy doing.
So just to finish up, I'll ask you this last question. This is where we normally try and pull a little quotation mark from our guest. Mm. I thought that was, by the way, you know, it was just nice to let you roll there because there was so much advice in that last bit. But if to end on a positive note, if you were to give the world one piece of advice, a small nugget to live a better and more meaningful life, what would it be?
Well, I'd have to steal it in the way that Savills and Isabel did, I would say, but obviously I'm just inspired by and reversioning. Famous line by Gandhi, which is, I think, you know, be the change that you want to make, or be the change that you want to see, or whatever the fuck it was that he said. But I like, you know, it's don't sit there and wait for it to happen. Just do it.
All right, we'll end it there. Dave, thank you so much for being
Pleasure.
On the show. It's
thank
been really
you.
Great.
Great to meet you.
Yeah, likewise.
Good luck with everything.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe and share. I'd also like to invite you to an ongoing project called the Move Me Mailing List. If you enjoyed the show, I'm confident you'll enjoy this newsletter. It contains links to all the great content I've uncovered each month, along with insights of any interesting opportunities I've discovered. You can subscribe to this by visiting my website at rickyrichards.com. A special thanks to Frankie Byrne and James Utting. They're the tech heads that make this show possible. The intro music was composed by Dom Stores Fox, and thanks again to Reese Chapman for introing me to Lou and Lizette, the wonderful folks at Factory Studios in London, where this show is recorded. Finally, wherever you are in the world, I hope you have a great day and keep creating. Until next time, bye for now.